Hi, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Dan Lystico, on behalf of the Fuels America Coalition. I want to welcome you to the call. We're going to be joined on today's call by four speakers. You should all have a press release from the Fuels America Coalition of the report that is being released today on this call. If you don't, you can get a hold of Aaron Wells on our team, who was on the original press advisory, and he can get that to you. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speakers. They're going to just say a few brief words at the top here, and then we will move to your questions. When we do get into the Q&A period, to ask a question, put yourself in the queue for questions, press star 3 on your phone. And if you want to go ahead and put yourself in the queue early, you're welcome to do that. Again, it's star 3. So with that, our four speakers today are John Doggett, who is the Vice President for Public Policy at the National Corn Growers Association, Adam Monroe, who is the America's Regional President for Novozymes North America, Larry Ward, who is the Senior Vice President of Project Development at POET, and John Dunham at John Dunham & Associates, who is the author of the report that's being released today. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to John Doggett.
Well, thank you, Dan, and thank you all of you for being on the call today. As Dan said, today the Fuels America Coalition is releasing an economic study which details the huge impact that renewable fuels has on our economy and on the job market, not only at a national level, but at a state and local level as well. You know, ethanol, biodiesel, and other renewable fuels represent about 10% of the nation's fuel supply. And as a result of that, we're seeing oil imports falling to the lowest level in decades. You know, when we produce more locally and buy less from overseas, that means jobs and opportunity for Americans and their families. You know, as this report shows, the renewable fuels industry now supports more than $184 billion of economic output. It supports more than 852,000 jobs and over $56 billion in wages, and it generates about $14.5 billion in state and local tax revenue every year. Taking a look at the state level, and just to choose a few states, it shows what the industry supports. For instance, in Wisconsin, it supports over $982 million in wages. In Michigan, it supports $4.2 billion in economic output, over 73,000 jobs in Iowa, over $64 million in tax revenues in North Dakota, and nearly $12 billion in economic output in Minnesota. But for the corn farmers that I represent, it goes beyond just the numbers. It goes to what's really happening in their communities and happening on their farms and happening with their families. When I talk to corn grower groups, I'll ask them, how many of you had a kid that came back to the farm in the last 5 years that would not have come back to the farm were it not for the renewable fuel standard and the ethanol industry? And I'll get 20-30% of the room to stand up. And when I get tough farmers come up with misty eyes and say, that's why this is so important, because my kid came back. Not only could I afford to have my kid and his or her family come back to the farm and get them into the operation, but we actually had an economically viable community where we had a movie theater, we had a hospital, the school district is doing well because of the economic impacts of biofuels. That's why it's important to our farmers. It gives them a way to go ahead and pass that farm on to the next generation. And a lot of those farms have been in that family for 3, 4, 5, and 6 generations. And if we can put a policy in place that extends it one more generation, that's really important to farm families across the country. The other thing to remember is all of this impact is happening without subsidies. The ethanol tax credit expired over 2 years ago. And now, instead of supporting jobs in Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, or Libya every time we fill up, we're supporting more jobs here in the United States. Now I'll turn it over to Adam Monroe.
Thank you. Sorry for being on mute there. Thank you, John. As president of Novozymes for the Americas, and for that matter, being in the global company we're in, I've watched the rise of biofuels in the industry in the United States happen, and it happened over a very short period of time, and the Renewable Fuel Standard is a big reason that that happened. What that spurred for our company was the most ambitious R&D project in our history. And this is a company with over 6,000 patents and $2 billion in revenue, and we spend a lot of money on R&D. That innovation drove a tremendous amount of R&D jobs, both focusing on improving the efficiency and the yield and everything that could be made from the grain-based ethanol that has been so successful in this country to date. And as a consequence, we have a huge sales force and technical service group in the Midwest, in Iowa, in Ames, Iowa, in Nebraska, and across the Midwest. But what it also spurred was an R&D project that ultimately resulted in us deciding to build a $200 million enzyme facility in Blair, Nebraska, where today we employ over 110 folks. While that plant was being built, there was over 400 construction workers on site for almost 3 years, and I can tell you that the town manager there loves to tell me about how sales taxes increased during that time pretty good in Blair. And today, that facility is up and running, and it is not only providing the latest cutting-edge enzymes for corn and grain-based ethanol, but it's also producing the enzymes for the advanced biofuels facilities that are now starting to be constructed and coming online across the country. This would not have happened without the Renewable Fuel Standard. And I have folks there at the facility all the time ask me about, you know, the future of the Renewable Fuel Standard and how important it has been. And it's an incredible story, but we're just at the beginning. And I think what people need to be reminded of, and I think why the attacks from the incumbents in the fuel space are attacking so hard now, is that they see this commercialization happening of advanced biofuels, and we see it too. We built that plant ahead of time so that we would be ready when these suppliers were going to come online. It's an incredible story. We're a third of the way through the journey. And it's going to mean tremendous things, not only across the Midwest, but across the country. We have R&D scientists in California. We just announced today a new ag R&D facility that we're going to start here in North Carolina, where I'm based. And the impact, not only directly to our customers, is huge, but to the suppliers that ship our products, to the raw material suppliers that bring us feedstock to make these enzymes, and everyone in between from the service side. In fact, when I know about Blair, roughly there's four people to every one people that we employ providing services to our operation. So the economic impact is tremendous. So I understand why the oil industry is taking a lot of shots at us today, because they're worried about the market share they're going to lose as it relates to importing oil into this country, et cetera. And I hope and encourage both the EPA and Congress to maintain the RFS as we know it, because it is a tremendous success story. With that, let me turn it over to Larry Ward of POET.
Thank you, Adam. POET, as many of you may know, is one of the largest renewable fuel producers both in the United States and the world. And in fact, we produce enough ethanol to offset the need for about 20 Exxon Valdez tankers each and every year. We were founded by a family out of Minnesota. We currently operate 27 biorefineries in seven different states, those including Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. And we have an annual production capacity of about 1.6 billion gallons of ethanol. at all of these plants. They provide good-paying direct jobs in these in rural small communities. These are jobs, as others have mentioned, that cannot be outsourced. These are great local jobs, direct jobs, highly technical jobs, good-paying jobs for all of those that are participating. Often, POET, our plants are in many cases the largest employer in the community and focus on job development activities for a whole region. We see community colleges in places like Iowa, North Dakota, Minnesota have developed new comprehensive programs for biofuels as part of their curriculums. That didn't exist 5 years ago, 10 years ago. These are programs where they're training residents for employment in the local biofuels industry. POET has been very involved in helping develop these programs across all of the states. It's also very common where we're bringing in and educating the youth in these communities. You'll have the grade schools, you'll have the middle schools, you'll have the high schools coming in, learning science, learning agriculture, learning about those businesses and inspiring those kids to be able to look into the future and look at jobs that are very meaningful in their home communities. We have seen opportunities similar to what John Doggett had mentioned earlier where young people are moving back or they're staying in their home area. We've seen the improvement in the entire business environment in the local communities due to the improved economic activities in all of these areas. At POET and with our plants, we take very seriously our role as active, positive members in the local business community and really providing a way to participate in these communities because we're employing the people of the local area and we're proud to be able to participate with them in being able to revitalize agriculture and the ethanol industry. Very exciting in the near future. These benefits are going to be magnified, frankly, manyfold as we, POET and DSM, bring cellulosic ethanol production to a commercial scale for the first time through our joint venture with DSM. We're finishing construction this quarter on Project Liberty. It's in Emmitsburg, Iowa. Already in Emmitsburg, we have seen new farm equipment dealerships open up. We've seen other businesses in the town open up. We have had over 500 construction jobs at one time in this facility in a small rural agricultural area. We have seen young people eager to get involved with agriculture, coming back to town, opening up businesses, understanding that they can participate on their family farm and in their family agricultural operations for the long term. It's been very exciting. We've seen, you know, ethanol production has been a boon to America. It's the biggest thing to happen, you know, to agriculture and to rural business in decades, and we're proud to be a part of that movement. And with that, I will turn it over to John Dunham.
And John, just before John Dunham starts here, I just want to remind folks, if you have a question, press star 3 on your phone, and we will get you in the queue for questions. John is the author of the study, and he can talk a little bit about the methodology, and then we'll move to questions. Go ahead, John.
Great. Thanks so much. I'm John Dunham. I'm the managing partner at John Dunham Associates. And I first want to just thank Fuels America for allowing us to do this work for them. It's an important study, and it brings a lot of information to bear about the industry. We've been conducting economic impact studies of this type for about 13 years and have done literally dozens and dozens of them for a wide range of industries. Our methodology and the methodology we use in this study is not based on broad average-type data and multipliers, but rather on the real jobs at each and every facility in the industry. That allows us to create a detailed study that calculates out the economic impact of the entire renewable fuels industry from corn growing through refining, through shipping, through the local fuel station. And by being able to do that, we literally have an economic impact study of each and every facility aggregated together. And this allows Fuels America to provide the kind of detailed analysis that's on the website right now and allows for, you know, for reporting of data in a way that is understandable and not just a bunch of Greek letters. This also, I think, importantly provides Fuels America with a very transparent model. This isn't a black box study hidden away. It's a very open architecture, and it allows everybody to see what's under the hood and to understand, you know, that this is real. So I'm happy to discuss the methodology in detail or any of the specific data elements with anybody during the question and answer period or even afterwards. And again, I thank Fuels America for allowing us to do this research for them.
Excellent. And again, it is *3 to get in the queue to ask a question. We'll go ahead and take the first question from Alice Berryman of the Detroit Business Magazine. Go ahead, Alice.
Hi. Can you just repeat more about what the economic benefits are producing renewable fuels, and if possible, specifically to Michigan? Hello.
Yeah, Larry, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, let me give an example of a facility we have in Carroll, Michigan. This is a plant that was built, I'm going to say, maybe somewhere around 10 years ago. That's a plant that is up near the thumb of Michigan. As it was being developed and as it grew, number one, it became a very strong local marketplace for the corn that was produced in the area. The plant facility was built, so during the construction period, which would have lasted in between 12 and 18 months, there was a strong employment as a result of construction by local contractors and others in the area. The facility, upon its startup, has employed somewhere around 40 team members on an annual basis that are good direct jobs in that community. Also created a lot of indirect jobs for suppliers, transportation, all of these other areas. The fuel that then is produced in that plant has been made available not only to the local area, but also regionally along the Ohio Valley and other areas. The process itself also produces a very high-value livestock feed for the local egg producers and livestock producers, so it provided a good new source of local nutrition for the livestock. And so it has also generated, you know, over $100 million annually of economic activity that would be turning back into the community. People would be buying at the grocery stores. They'd be buying automobiles. And so it really has a strong multiplier effect in that region. In Michigan, there's many other plants as well that have replicated that type of model. So it has a far-reaching type of economic impact, both in terms of direct employment as well as indirect employment, and really a fostering and a support for the entire agricultural community.
And I would just add to that, when you go onto the website, which is linked from the press release, you should... You can click on Michigan and make sure you probably select economic impact report as opposed to the table, because it'll give you a little bit more narrative that may be helpful. But for Michigan, for example, it's $4.2 billion in economic output, almost 23,000 jobs, over $1 billion in wages supported, as well as $136 million in state tax revenue. So it's a very significant impact in Michigan. With that, we'll go ahead to Cesar from Reuters. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time this morning. I just had two questions real quick. The first one is on the jobs figure. 5 years ago, Gross Energy was running an ad that said ethanol could create 136,000 American jobs. This morning, the figure is 855,000. The 136 figure came out at the hearing at the Senate Agriculture Committee just a couple weeks back. So I'm just wondering, you know, how do we go from 136,000 jobs to, you know, 155?
It was cutting out a little bit there, but it sounded like the question was sort of, you know, how does it comport with past estimates? John, do you want to take a crack at that, John Dunham?
Yeah.
And then there's a reminder to folks, if you have a question, to press *3.
Yeah, sure. A lot of that has to do with how an industry is defined. In this case, we're looking at the broad renewable fuels industry, which is everything from corn, yeah, from not just corn, but the growing of agricultural products that are used as feedstocks, all the way through to the sale in a fueling station. Now, we're not calculating, we're not including, say, every job at a local fuel station. we're just calculating the part that is the jobs that are selling the ethanol-based products. A lot of that has to do with the definition. If you're defining the industry more narrowly, you're going to have a lot smaller number than if you define the industry broadly. Also, over time, industries change, and this is an industry that's been growing fairly rapidly. So comparing 2013 numbers, which these really are, with actually these are 2014 numbers, these are new numbers, 2014 numbers, so numbers from right now with numbers from, say, 2010 or earlier could make a very meaningful difference. Does that answer your question, Sarah?
Did any of the other speakers on the call want to say a word about that and how the industry's grown?
This is Adam. I think I can add a couple of points there. One is, and it always amazes me when I look at this, since 2008, when we had the economic meltdown, this industry built, I believe, over 100 manufacturing plants in this country at a time that we desperately needed them. And that rapid increase, along with a lot of innovation looking at the advanced space, created a whole wave of activity to see what else, you know, we can do to foster new ways of making fuels from all of these different kinds of materials. So to me, it's not necessarily a surprise if you went back 5 years and just looked at the volume expectations and you could extrapolate jobs from that. But I think what we underestimated was the incredible amount of innovation that it spurred and all of the activity and the jobs that surrounded that as well. And today, when you look at the efficiency of the corn ethanol plants, or you look at the different number of feedstocks or technologies that can be employed to make advanced biofuels, it's an amazing story for the country and innovation. So I'm not surprised, actually, that the job figure now is much bigger than what we even imagined 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay, again, it is star 3 to ask a question. We've got a few more minutes here for questions. We'll go to James Anderson from Illinois Radio Network. Go ahead, James.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I've got a question for John Doggett, please. Two questions, actually. First of all, would you please describe the nature of the jobs that have been generated in Illinois? And then the second question is going to be, would you say what the status is of the renewable fuel standard? I wasn't aware that it was in doubt. I thought it had just been strengthened.
Well, tell you what, let me have John Dunham handle the numbers question. Because he's a lot better at that than I am. But is the renewable fuel standard in trouble? Yes, it is. And we were seeing a huge amount of money being spent by the petroleum industry and by others who are actively lobbying the Congress, attempting to get to line up enough votes to be successful to either reform, which could be depends on what you call reform, but that would mean that they would significantly reduce the amount of ethanol required in the nation's gasoline supply, or they would repeal the renewable fuel standard. So it is under attack. I was at a meeting a couple weeks ago where a representative of the American petroleum industry told a group of about 1,000 people that the American Petroleum Institute, representing the oil industry, had over 200 votes in the House of Representatives to either repeal or reform the renewable fuel standard. You only need 218 to be successful on the floor of the House of Representatives. We know they're working it every day. The folks that work for us are working the hallways as well, but we're outnumbered and we're outgunned.
This is John Dunham. Just really quick on the types of jobs. Again, this study is a very broad, so we're looking at from really farm to tank, and so that includes a lot of different types of people, including farmers, including folks working in a convenience store. But on average in Illinois, just on average, these jobs pay about $60,400. So these are real jobs. These are real decent jobs for real people. When you look at the induced effect, of which is a big number as well, those are jobs in the general economy. So those are jobs that happen when people working in a refinery go out and spend their money in the local economy. So those would reflect the general economy of the state. But the direct jobs themselves are extremely good jobs. $60,500 wage is pretty good in this country.
And before we move to our next question, I just wanted to note that yesterday the Fuels America Coalition rolled out oilrigged.com, and one of the things that was noted on oilrigged.com is that the oil industry has spent in the last 5 years almost $1 billion, $855 million, on lobbyists and campaign contributions, among other things, to try to get rid of the renewable fuel standard and get more tax breaks for themselves. And over that period of time, they've done pretty well for their, you know, $1 billion investment. They've made about $20 billion in tax subsidies and almost $500 billion in profits. So with that, we'll move to Jane Scheppel from the Wisconsin State Farmer. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, hi. I was curious how any of the people on the call would react. We've had economists that have said the ethanol industry is mature, and I wonder how any of you would react to that.
This is Larry, and I would make a comment as far as mature industry. When we take a look at the fuels industry as a whole, you're going to see an oil industry and a gasoline industry that's over 100 years old. The ethanol industry is just a mere fraction of that, really dating back in earnest less than 20 years of being in a strong market position and growing. Back at the time, you had less than 1% used in the gasoline supply at that time. So we've seen tremendous growth over the last 10, 15, 20 years in the industry. We have, gone through, we've grown through a lot of innovation, as many others have mentioned. We have grown because of technology. We have grown because the fuel is a very delicate, and I should say a very strong and a competitive fuel from an octane standpoint and a mixing standpoint. But really, very simply, the oil industry has been very mature. It's had tax breaks that have been put into place for many, many years, and it's embedded in the tax code. The ethanol industry today survives really on the market opportunity that it has. It no longer has any of the tax incentives that were in place over a couple of years ago, and it has really continued to grow, and really we see a lot of opportunity in the future for greater access to the consumer for ethanol. One of the biggest things that we would need is greater access to the infrastructure in the fuel supply that is many times limited by our opponents.
Yeah, and this is Adam. If I can just add to that, whether this industry is mature is definitely in the eye of the beholder. And I would say for those of us in the industry, we are nowhere near mature. If you look at the goals in the RFS in and of itself, we are only a third of the way there. If we look at the enormous potential this country has in its biomass resources as well as its traditional resources, we have enough resource out there to, supplant way more fuel than we have even outlined in the RFS. So the potential is enormous. I would say we're a long way from being mature. However, if the oil industry does a good job, and I hate to say it, but some of the latest rulings from the EPA are sending uncertainty signals into the industry, then they're trying to define us as being mature, as if somehow you can't drive on more than 10% renewable fuel. And if you believe that, then you should ask the Brazilians what they think about that, when every day they drive around on 25% as a standard minimum. So I think we're a long way from being mature.
Go ahead. Real quick,
I was going to say, when you think about the idea of a mature industry, you're talking about one that's sort of stagnated. But I don't know, making grape nuts or something like that. But when you have any industry, it could be a very, very young industry, a very old industry that has a lot of productivity growth and a lot of research and development going on, you can hardly call it a stagnant, immature industry. And productivity growth in the renewable fuels industry and the energy industry as a whole in this country has been tremendous. There's a lot of investment going on in this industry, and that's going to change it dramatically over the next few years.
All right, very good. I want to try to get to some more questions. Before I do that, let me just, since we've got a number of folks on the call, let me just give you the names and spellings again so that folks who are needing to identify them have all of that. So it's John Doggett, the Vice President for Public Policy at the Corn Growers Association. It's D-O-G-G-E-T-T. Adam Monroe, from Nozymes North America, and Larry Ward, who is the Senior Vice President of Project Development at POET, along with John Dunham, D-U-N-H-A-M, from John Dunham and Associates, and John and his team did the study. We're going to go to Kevin Burbach from the AP in North Dakota. Go ahead, Kevin. Kevin, you still with us? Bear with us 1 second. Sorry, had a little technical difficulty there. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yes, I'm hoping to talk a little bit about the success of the renewable energy industry in a particular state. Say, South Dakota seems it's fared about three times better. It has an output of about $6.9 billion, while North Dakota has about $2.5 billion. What are some main factors that determine the success of the industry in a particular state?
This is Larry. One of the key components for the renewable fuels industry is feedstock supply. And so those areas in the U.S. that has the largest amount of feedstock supply, be it corn or other types of supply, probably is going to have more opportunity for the growth and the development of that industry. North Dakota, relative to many of their states, and John, you may have some additional numbers as well as far as corn production and others. While it's it is a very good agricultural producing state, it does have volumes that would be significantly less than other states such as Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, some of the other states that have more acres dedicated to the production of feedstocks.
Another thing you want to take into account is the mix of the types of firms in the different states. South Dakota has a lot more refining, manufacturing type companies, type firms, type locations than does North Dakota. And you just get more economic bang for the buck from manufacturing than you do from agriculture or from retailing.
And
you very good. Output, think of output as GDP.
And again, if anyone does have a final question, press *3 on your phone. We're going to go to Michelle from Farm World. Go ahead, Michelle.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call. In the past few months, there's been at least one study saying that the potential damage to the environment by ethanol outweighs any benefits. And I just wondered if any of you had any response to studies like that.
This is John Doggett, and let me start to address that. There's been a lot of discussion about one or two studies that have said mm-hmm. ethanol is bad. But, you know, for every one of those, there's 10 that say it's good. So what I'm curious about is, you know, it's a man bites dog story when there's something that says ethanol is bad. And, of course, I think that some in the petroleum industry have kicked those stories along a little bit. But, you know, consistently, the Argonne Labs, EPA, USDA, land-grant universities across the country have done a whole host of studies saying that ethanol production, both starch-based and cellulosic-based ethanol production, reduces greenhouse gas emissions and is good for the environment. But again, you know, we had a study that was released I guess over the weekend, and I've heard more about that one study than I have heard about any four other studies that have been published in the last couple of years that say ethanol is good.
And this is Adam. We're in the innovation business, so we see lots of studies, and the study John is referring to that just came out, I think in some ways is a classic case of some of the things you see where someone's done research and they choose a timeline which is very different than the global standards of how you would evaluate in any sort of renewable alternative. This particular professor used, you know, a five-year horizon when IPCC uses 20, EPA uses 30, or vice versa. It's very odd timing that's chosen. Also, the study indicated a particular way in which you would remove crop residue from a field that you would never do in reality. So it makes me often wonder why, what's the motivation there to do something that is very counter to the standard ways and practices in which we actually do things in this industry. So I just back John to say argon and a lot of other in-depth, well-done studies, peer-reviewed, are out there that are much more supportive and I think much more accurate of the realities of renewable fuels.
Any other comments on that question? If not, we will leave it.
Yeah, this is Larry. I'll add one piece of context, because as part of the information of the study was referring to agricultural residue, and we will be utilizing agricultural residue at the Emmitsburg facility. And we have been doing research over the last 6 years with Iowa State University and others, doing research on the different types of removal and so forth. And we have found very encouraging results through those studies. We continue doing those studies, and we find that they are mostly beneficial for the farming practices that we have seen. But we continue to do research in those areas.
I was also going to suggest you could follow up with Paul Winters over at the Biotechnology Industry Organization. They had just released a study which shows that the EPA's proposal dialing back the RFS would increase CO2 emissions in the U.S. just this year by an amount that almost completely wipes out all of the reductions in CO2 that have happened since the beginning of 2009. So with that, I think we're going to wrap up. I want to thank all of our speakers and all of our participants for all of your great questions. If you have follow-up questions, you can address those to Aaron Wells, who is the one that sent out the advisory. His contact information is there. If not, it is Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at smootetwos.com. So that's smootetwes.com. Thanks, everyone, for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.